call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. Friday, March 22nd, 2019. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Coghill, Senator Geisel, Senator Stevens, myself, Senator Wilson. Senator Begich may call in off net, but he's excused from the call today. On Wednesday, we heard from the chair of the Citizen Review Panel. Today, we'll hear the response from the Office of Children's Services. Presenting today is our OCS Director, Natalie Norberg. This is the third year in a row that OCS has provided a response to the Citizens Review Panel to the to our committee. And with that, feel free to start when ready, Ms. Norberg.
Thank you, Senator Wilson, and members of the committee for having me here today. For the record, my name is Natalie Norberg, and I'm the director of the Office of Children's Services. I wanted to start off by just acknowledging and thanking the Citizen Review Board for their work, especially the new chair, J.P. Ouellette, for their extensive commitment and volunteer time on the board. I feel like we're all in this together, and it's not necessarily a fun assignment that he has, and so I do appreciate their work. I also really appreciate the new emphasis on collaboration. I feel like it's very appreciated that the Citizen Review Board is trying to intentionally align their priorities with the Office of Children's Services' priorities, because we don't really have a lot of latitude in our priorities. So many of the things that we have to focus on are very much compliance driven by the federal government. We have over 36 different compliance measures that we must adhere to by having a state-run child protection system. So that they are willing to align with us is very important.
And before you continue, Ms. Norberg, I just want to announce that Senator Begich is online with us today.
Thank you. So one of the first areas that you heard Mr. Ouellette speak about earlier this week was the administrative review process. This is an important process. It was put in place in 1997, and basically the purpose of it is to provide, it was instituted by the federal government to create a third level review of oversight for cases. So the purpose is really to make sure that our cases are having an outside perspective, someone that's not directly tied to the case, is making sure that there's certain elements happening on the case, that there's a time frame, that there's a case plan, that everyone knows what they need to be doing. It's very important. We don't disagree. However, many states have implemented this process into their judicial system. Alaska is only one of two states that didn't implement it into their judicial review system. And so we really feel like many of the elements of the reviews are actually already incorporated into court hearings. And so for us, it's very much, it feels like a redundant process. So we remain steadfast that we want to continue to work towards having our administrative reviews incorporated into the judicial system. And as part of our program improvement plan that we're negotiating right now with the federal government, we've decided to, we're working very closely with the court improvement program and implementing a pilot in the Fairbanks judicial court system. They've agreed to take on the elements of the reviews into their hearings, many of which are already incorporated in those hearings. It will only require an additional hearing after the first year is in place. And again, after the case has been in the system for about a year. And again, it's a pilot. So we'll be examining its effectiveness and its efficiencies, but we're very hopeful that this is going to be a process that's going to work out and be a better use of resources. As you can see on the previous slide, we employ almost 6 full-time employees, and their job is almost exclusively to do these reviews. So again, it's a high utilization of our resources. The other outcome area that the Citizen Review panel has focused attention on is our family reunification rates. Family reunification is a very important and priority goal of all cases when a family first hits the child welfare system. Alaska has currently, in 2018, our reunification rate was at 54.5%. Nationally, it's 49%. So we are doing a little bit better than the national average. We think we could continue to be doing better. And there are a lot of really great strategies that the CRP identified, of which many we are completely aligned with and are working on, specifically around really trying to train and have our caseworkers embrace the notion of reunification. And sometimes that's sometimes they hit some barriers with that. We think some of the two most important systemic issues related to our ability to impact reunification is a stable workforce, which I'll talk about more later, and the accessibility of appropriate community services. It's really important for us not to rush reunification if a family's not ready. We want to be careful that we don't have repeat reentries. And so OCS does not provide direct interventions other than creating the linkages and helping families access the community resources. And if there are no community resources, then it makes our work very difficult. So we're really excited about the 1115 behavioral health waiver. I was fortunate to be able to be a part of some of the initial design work on the 1115 behavioral health waiver. I worked on some of the work groups that helped look at the target populations and the services that would be made available. And I'm very happy that one of the target populations for the 1115 behavioral health waiver is families that are at risk of entering the foster care system. So that whole initiative has been designed primarily, one of the primary targets is, what are the services that are needed to help our families that are really struggling, and what are the community-based supports that should be and must be made available for those families. OCS is participating. OCS is participating right now in the current gap analysis that's happening. This is a statewide initiative that the Division of Behavioral Health is working on with through the contract and the assistance of the Mental Health Trust. There's a gap analysis going on, and all major Alaska communities are being visited by a team of folks from the Division of Behavioral Health and from the Office of Children's Services, meeting with providers specifically to ask about their capacity, what they need, helping them understand what the new services will be under the waiver. And also OCS is a part of that process so that we can have that intimate conversation with providers about what are the specific needs of families in the child welfare system and how are they going to be able to take advantage of these new funding opportunities and to be able to really provide those important in-home family supports that our families so desperately need.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your comments. I'm responding to some questions from some of my constituents about a racial difference in family reunification. Do you have any figures on that? Do you look at it racially at all? Or?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, yes, we do. Actually, I'm happy to report that the reunification rate for Alaska Native American Indian children in the state of Alaska is higher right now than it is for their non-white counterparts. So it's actually around 55%, I believe, while the reunification rate for non-Native children is closer to 50%.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, thank you very much for that.
And take a moment to pause and see if Senator Begich has any questions. Senator Begich, are you with us?
I am. I have no questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
The next opportunity that we are very optimistic about, although it's definitely we're in the exploration stage, is the Family First Prevention Services Act. This is a very large piece of legislation that was passed by the U.S. Congress last year, and it opens up the opportunity for states to claim up to 50% reimbursement through the Title IV-E program, which is the open-ended entitlement that funds pretty much all child welfare services through the federal government. So this is a very new opportunity, which for the first time will allow for the purchase of services. Never before have we been able to use this funding stream for services. So this is an excellent opportunity. However, there are obviously certain criteria that must be in place. And one is that the children must meet certain criteria related to being candidates for foster care, which basically means they had the family has had to have come into the come to the attention of the child welfare system and are determined to have the needs that would suggest that if they didn't have some kind of intervention that they would be a candidate for coming into care. They also may be pregnant or parenting youth. And then the services themselves are very prescribed. The federal government has been somewhat slow in delivering the list of the certain services that will be available to be provided through this program. You can see that they have to be an evidence-based program. And we have received a preliminary list of those services. And so we are exploring right now provider capacity, as I mentioned, in the gap analysis process and through other outreach efforts to figure out. Obviously, there are some of these programs that currently exist in Alaska, but many of them don't. And this is, of course, not an exhaustive list. The more exhaustive list should come out in May of this year. Also, these services can be paid for only as a last resort after Medicaid. And so there's a lot of, there's going to be a lot of figuring out of all of this, but we definitely see it as a positive opportunity to create more targeted services for families in the child welfare system.
On the 4E, that is this going to be, on the 4E, you have to do a compliance on a whole range of things. So is this going to like be a new set of criteria or an additional to what you already do, or is it rearranging the whole criteria? Because I know that, that review is an extensive review.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, it is separate criteria. So the eligibility criteria to allow for children in the foster care system to be eligible for reimbursement and the activities that caseworkers can engage in to draw down those funds. The eligibility for the child part is completely separate, so that won't impact like our eligibility ratio. However, the types of services that the case management related services will be the similar to what the existing infrastructure is. So, but mostly we won't have the you know, there's a lot of specific, and I know what you're thinking of, the those criteria for foster homes to be licensed in a certain way and the family to have met certain income requirement tests. That does, those kinds of things do not apply to the new dollars because they are not entering the foster care system. So it's a little looser.
And, summary, and the Family First Prevention Service Act covers a myriad of different opportunities for the state. This is sort of a, I don't call it tip of the iceberg, but there's also funding for, if I'm correct, about foster youth. The age range has extended for grant funding or opportunities to continuing with continuing education or vocational type trainings as well.
Senator Wilson, thank you. You are the chair. There is the opportunity for states to expand the reimbursement rate for the age of children who are what we consider in our independent living category. Alaska did not choose to expand simply because it was such a smaller population. So we did not elect to take that particular opportunity. But there are other dollars that are able to come through for independent living services. There was an extension of the act and the funding through the through the bill. So some of it doesn't, we're not necessarily taking it advantage of because of the economy of scale for Alaska didn't necessarily make sense for us in our opinion. But there definitely, you are correct, there are many aspects of this act of which the Office of Children's Services is and has already taken advantage of, in essence.
And I guess I was just hoping that maybe that might be an opportunity for the university to get involved in working with foster youth and working within their programs and certifications to try to have a partnership with the department in terms of trying to expand on some of those funds, but I guess not.
Senator Wilson, we do have a we do currently have a partnership with the university, and we do provide extensive support through a particular program to assist foster care youth in their journey to get a college education. I am happy to report that last year we had the highest number of high school graduates and youth enrolled and graduating from the university than ever before. We do partner with the university to offer educational scholarships. They're called educational training vouchers. And so we do offer that program. That is a program that we take advantage of in the state of Alaska, and many more youth than ever before being able to take advantage of that wonderful program.
Is that funded through UGF, sort of our general fund dollars or federal dollars?
Those dollars do come from the federal government.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Systemic therapy, methadone, maintenance therapy, it says that's base in-home parent scale base through parents as teachers. Is that the program that has been eliminated in the governor's budget?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I'm not aware of that program having been eliminated. Are you talking about the Parents as Teachers program specifically?
Maybe different agencies call the same thing, but there is a Parents as Teachers program that we have statewide, and I'm not sure if this is the same thing, and that has been eliminated, I believe, in this budget, right?
I could tell you.
We will try to get a department response from the department on that question.
And Mr. Chairman, my real question is, if that has been eliminated, what do we do then with this program?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I'm a little... this Parents as Teachers program is a model that is used in our state. There is a model, it's an evidence-based model, and currently the Division of Public Health within the Department of Health and Social Services does support one program. And then there are other grants and other programs provided through nonprofit agencies around the state who also support the same model. And so we're very interested in partnering with those entities to see if there's a way that we can somehow draw down this new funding opportunity to help offset those existing expenses, those existing, you know, the programs that are already existing. This is a wonderful opportunity to see if there's some way we can supplement the funding through this new opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, so in the governor's budget, Best Beginnings and several early learning programs have been eliminated, and one is called Parents as Teachers. That may be two different things called by the same name, so I'm not sure, but if you could get back to us, I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I think it's just more of the modality of the service that is provided. And so if that agency provided this modality of service, then that funding may have been cut, but it is reimbursable under this new act. And I think that's the difference, if that's this number. But we'll try to have a response back to the committee members. I'm trying to get a defined definition of how this all interacts.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the number three priority that had been identified by the Citizens Review Panel, the issue of cultural competency, this remains an important priority for the Office of Children's Services because of our continued disproportionality rate of Alaska Native children in the child welfare system. So currently today, we have 64% of our cases are comprised of children who are Alaska Native or American Indian. And that population of Alaska Native children only make up, they're only 23% of the entire child population in Alaska, so it is quite a disparate number. So we have been working hard, and we appreciate the Citizen Review Panel's continued support of this as a priority. We do offer our staff a number of different trainings And we've tried to do some creative things that perhaps no other divisions or departments within the state do, and that is we invite tribal partners to be a part of the interviewing team for many of our critical positions, our frontline staff positions, and for supervisory positions, because we feel like it's important that the people that we hire, that our tribal partners feel comfortable working with them. And so that is a commitment that we've made, and we've received the Department of Administration's permission to be able to do this.
And I see that it's actually on this slide too, and that is, there's three things I think we're dealing with here on this and on cultural competency. One of them is how we deal with people of blended families, right? How we deal with people that are specifically Iqua, and then you get to deal with the tribal groups that don't always follow the Iqua rule, if I understand correctly. And that cultural competency in compacting, I see it's up on your next slide, is how do you blend some of those things? Because at one point, we have children that have both a federal and state requirement, but I think the tribal groups have a little different view of it. Is that a communication that you've done well? Is there what more can we do, or is there a pretty good working relationship at this point with some of the tribal court groups who have, you know, got some authority, some by courts and some by federal money, but are we working well there, or what are some of the disparate parts?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I'm trying to specifically identify your question. I think you're asking about how our relationships are currently with tribal governments.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could clarify. We have some very clear, like you said, very directive rules.
That is correct.
With the federal and the state, right? Mm-hmm. ICWA has very directive. Is that also true with some of the tribal groups, since they don't operate under those same directives? Maybe that's a better way of stating it.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, through the chair. Yes, the requirements of the Indian Child Welfare Act do not apply to tribal governments who are taking over their own child welfare cases. Because they are the tribe, they do not have to adhere to the same oversight, and they can basically provide the services and conduct their child welfare systems in any form or fashion that they decide. Because the Indian Child Welfare Act is really about making sure that the state allows for tribes to have that legal intervention and that legal ability to have say and be a legal party to the case. So because we have so many different tribal jurisdictions in Alaska, it is a very complicated process for our staff to navigate, and we do it better in some regions than in others. The working relationship, for example, as Mr. Ouellette indicated on Wednesday, is working really well in, for example, Sitka. Sitka is one tribe out of 229. So it's a lot of navigating for our staff, and we could do a better job of helping our staff understand the nuances between tribal courts, tribal social service entities, the tribal health. There's so many different aspects, and it's very confusing for our brand new workers. But we do really work hard, and we have implemented a lot of different strategies to help bridge opportunities for our staff to get to know and understand these different systems and to be aware of, you know, the very rich and important and exciting opportunities that having such a diverse tribal community, so many diverse tribal communities, what that brings to our families in Alaska.
And I'm going to ask for a quick follow-up to that question on ICWA, on the Indian Child Welfare Act. There's a current federal case going on right now that's a subject to be heard in the Supreme Court. Has that in any way, any injunctions or that court case changed the way currently the state has been operating with our Indian Child Welfare Act within our state?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, no, there has been no injunctions at this time.
Yeah, the particular case is probably going to come out of Texas. Their Supreme Court found one thing, and then we'll see if that finds its way up to the Supreme Court. But I don't know that we're going to be under any injunctions. I just wanted to bring this forward because there's a difference between cultural competency and legal directives. Very, very different. And both the review panel and the OCS are traveling in a pretty interesting world. They want to take the best out of the culture, but the legal entanglement isn't always very well described. And so we've tried very hard to try to figure out how to do that. At the other hand, the Native children, the Alaska Native children, never should lose their right as a citizen of the United States. And so that's one of the things, and we haven't figured that out totally. But in the meanwhile, the best care at a local level is still the best care. And so trying to figure out how to work all those things. And I just wanted to highlight the competency is one thing, but the legal rules are a very different thing. I just wanted to highlight that.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I many of the things we're talking about are new to me, so when I see them, I wonder what they are. Cultural humility curriculum. Humility. What is that? Cultural humility. I'm working on humility, but what are you trying to teach your staff about cultural humility, and what is that?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, cultural humility really refers to the ability to be respectful of other cultures and to not necessarily think that you're. It's just being humble and having an openness to learning about other cultures and respecting other cultures. And because our staff must work with such a diverse population, we think that's really important that they understand and respect and want to learn and understand the strengths of different cultures. That's really what it's about.
Thank you. Just an odd choice of words, and what it applies to, seems to say to me is that the humility of your own culture, so it doesn't interfere with dealing with people in other cultures. Is that sort of it?
That could potentially be part of that. Could potentially be part of the messaging. Yes.
Okay. Before we go on, checking in with Senator Begich. Senator Begich, you have any comments?
I have questions, but I'll hold them to the end. There's just mine aren't directly related to this, but earlier you did, with the exception of one. Earlier you mentioned the program at the university. With the high graduation rates, and I just wonder how many people are we talking about when we're, the number that of kids that got into that program, and what number are we talking about?
Senator Begich, through the chair, we can get you those numbers. I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head. It's not like it's under probably 25.
Thank you.
And please continue.
This topic came up earlier this week with the Citizen Review Panel's presentation. Finding relatives for placement for children in foster care, of course, remains a high priority for the Office of Children's Services. We have done a lot of things over the last 5 years, especially to really improve our effectiveness in this area. We are slowly beginning to see the numbers of children placed in relatives increase. So in the last 5 years, we've seen that number increase by approximately 10%. What's interesting, though, is that when we look at a child's life over their entire span or experience in child in foster care, oftentimes they were placed at least once with a relative, but sometimes those placements don't last. And so we really do try to prioritize that, but for whatever reasons, it can be very challenging for family members to take on additional their relatives. We try to support them. So when you see that the numbers haven't increased that much, it's a varying number. It's a constantly changing number. But we have done some interesting things, which I think this committee might want to know about, which is, through our ORCA system, we did implement a somewhat a partially automated system such that when the names of relatives are entered into our system, we do have the capability of generating an automated letter that goes, it's completely automated, so it even, you know, no one touches it. It just magically appears and goes into an envelope and gets mailed to inform relatives that they have a relative child in the child welfare system. That is a requirement for us to notify within the first 30 days of a child being removed, to notify all known relatives, and then throughout the life of the case at various intervals, especially if there's going to be an adoption of the child, we must re-notify relatives to let them know that there's still this opportunity, if the child is not placed with a relative, to be adopted into a relative home. We do have the first scope of work that was taken on by our tribal compacting co-signers was about doing relative searches for the Office of Children's Services. So this is an area that we've basically worked an amazing system out with our tribal partners, that they are actually doing this search, the searching for us and entering. They have access to our electronic filing system, and they're entering the relatives in our system on the state's behalf, and then those letters automatically get generated. And then because of House Bill 151, there were new training and new policy requirements for the supervisory oversight of making sure relative searches are happening on an ongoing basis, and so those have been implemented as well.
Where are you going? The automated noticing system, is that, I mean, can, let's say if a person that has a child, is that something that those potential parents that are being removed, are they putting those relatives in there as well? Or is it just what is already known from the department?
Senator Wilson, so part of the relative search process requires somebody to interview the parents and ask for all known relatives. And then from there, any relatives that are identified, those individuals are asked, and then it just branches out like a tree. Sometimes parents may be reluctant to provide the names of their relatives. That's actually quite common. And so it can be a challenge, and then we use what we can in terms of electronic databases, and again, the tribes have access to their tribal enrollment databases, and so we use a variety of sources, including like the PFD database and a bunch of other things, to figure out who the relatives are for our children.
Okay. And with the finding placement for sort of the kinship care, going to foster care, I had a constituent in my office 2 weeks ago who shared a story upon how she had siblings that, you know, she was going through the foster care system, the process in HB 151 that was passed last year shortened that time down, that they have 45 days, hoping that that would help expedite certain situations. But when talked to the worker now says, oh, I got 45 days to complete you. And during that time, they've already had three placements during that time before they were actually certified by the department. Has that something that's been going on a little bit more now that, you know, we have 45 days, so we're going to push it off to 45 days? Is that the new norm, or?
Senator Wilson, I'm sorry. Our policy states that the Office of Children's Services has 45 days to assess a request for placement. So there can sometimes be quite a lengthy background check and home inspection needed to determine whether or not a family is appropriate to take, you know, a relative child. So sometimes we get numerous inquiries and requests on a particular child, which is wonderful. The timeline has not changed. We are trying to adhere to that more because we did have complaints that it was taking a very long time to assess relatives. So we really do try to adhere to that. I believe this committee is aware of all of the multiple demands that caseworkers have. And so, you know, identifying and exploring numerous relatives placements when the child perhaps is in a placement, an appropriate placement, may or may not be the top priority for that particular day. But it's certainly our expectation that every relative that's identified has a thorough that there's a thorough examination done to determine whether or not they're appropriate. And then when there's multiple appropriate homes, then it's a very difficult decision that has to be made with respect to who's going to get that child. So it can be quite complex and multi-layered.
Yeah. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year, I think when we were dealing with, I think it was House Bill 151, we were all visited by foster children, and the shock to me was the two young ladies that came to see me had both been in something like 8 to 10 different foster families. Is that common, and does that every time a new foster family is identified, is that an additional 45 days to find that family? How does that work? And do you keep track of the number of times that a child is in a foster home?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, yes, we do keep track. We have to keep track of where all the children are placed and how many placements they are in. Every time a placement disrupts, it can take quite some time to find a new placement. Unfortunately, many of our children in the foster care system have many grief and loss and trauma issues, and those manifest in behaviors that can be quite challenging for foster families and for all involved. And so unfortunately, yes, there is the very sad situation of children having to be moved, not because they want to, but because their home just, and sometimes family circumstances change. They might have a sick relative, or they decide to move. So there's lots of variables. Oftentimes, we can't find a placement right away, or we can find a temporary placement. The family says, yes, I'll take this child, but I can only take him for 2 weeks, and then they have to go someplace else. And so, yes, unfortunately, children have to move around. It's a very, very, very sad part of the work.
Thank you.
I included this slide to try to provide an overview of the efforts that we've been making as a result of House Bill 151. There was a lot of new requirements for the Office of Children's Services in that bill, and we've been working very hard to implement them all. So some of the most important pieces to that bill was the addition of some new positions, 21 new positions that came into our division. The bill was signed in June of 2018, and we were given authority to begin recruiting for those positions in July of 2018. And many of the positions did not get filled until approximately October. And then this chart sort of shows the process. We've worked really hard over the last year to incorporate the new training requirements. We have an excellent relationship with the training academy through the university. It's our child welfare academy, and they work with us whenever there's new requirements or we feel that there's we're getting information that perhaps some part of the training's not working. We're constantly revamping and changing that training to make it meet our needs and then different needs of our students or our staff that are going through the program. So you can see that in essence it takes approximately 2 months from the time we get allowed to post a recruitment to when we can actually hire someone. And then our training is spread out through this four-month period. And it's mixed up with a lot of time in the field, because what we hear often is that classroom training is great, but when I get to the field, I don't know what to do. And so we have mixed it up, and we are trying new strategies, including the mentorship program, which was something that House Bill 151 also allowed us to do, which was add five. We have now five traveling mentors that go and are assigned to specific staff after they go through their classroom training that work with them in the field, and they're available more. They're more available to them than their direct supervisor in some cases, so that they can have real-time support when they're trying to make decisions and trying to figure out what to do and what policy should they be following right now. And so it's just, we really think that the transfer of learning process is improving with the way we're doing our new training system. But it does take time. And so we did have the question, how long is it? Where are there all those positions? What are their case carrying capacity? I would like the committee to know that with the new positions, Our analysis is that we can be afforded a 35% vacancy rate. We have 231 frontline positions at the Office of Children's Services. 231. Currently on this day, we have 134 of those filled. We have a vacancy rate of 51.7%. We can only have 35% vacancy rate for us to be able to implement caseload standards. As of today, we also have 53% of our staff have only been on the job 1 year or less. So retention remains one of our highest priorities and crises at this moment. We simply do not have the staff, right? We continue to not have the staff to do the job. And it's better in certain parts of the state. When we received the first, we did receive 31 new positions in 2017, and we began filling those, and I think you may have heard that the majority of those positions went to our Wasilla office because they have a very large population growth in that area. We essentially doubled their staff out there, and in about approximately a year and a half that they've had that extra staff, their vacancy rate has gone down to about 40%, and we're starting to see some really wonderful results with respect to their ability to get out and do the casework that we want them to be doing, meeting with families, engaging with in, you know, creating case plans, visiting children, making sure kids are safe. So we're beginning to see some really positive results because of the influx in positions that we received about a year and a half ago. But it does take time for these positions to get trained and to get into a position where they can start taking on caseloads. We don't anticipate being able to implement. We aren't required by the bill to implement the caseload caps until June of 2020, and we won't be implementing those caseload caps until we have enough staff to do it, because it absolutely would not be safe for us to do that.
And on that same thing, and I'm very appreciative for the additional staff out in the Mat-Su area with our growing population. Is there the capacity and space for them to work efficiently as well? I ask this because I remember my time working with that office, that they were so, you know, we get people in the hallways working their laptops sort of fill, and I know that there was a space right next door that was open, and they were waiting for that space to be open. And when I asked, inquired about that, they said, "Well, we're not going to do that now. We're shifting the items." As we're looking at the budget process now, I just didn't know if that was something that was considered in terms of the space and office allocations. I know Bethel is they're looking for more space. I'm not sure on the Anchorage situation. I just didn't know in all the statewide capacity, what is the space utilization if we're looking to increase the number of staff for their workflow efficiency. And I'm sure that will help in your next slide in the vacancies and retention as well.
Senator Wilson, thank you for that question. Currently, I believe that the Wasilla office does have enough space. Some of their staff did move into the new Child Advocacy Center, and so some of them are moved off-site from the rest of the staff, which isn't necessarily ideal, but then it works better for their workflow particularly. New staff does create the need for more space, of course, and much more expensive lease agreements. And so it is something that we've been struggling with to figure all of that out. I think we have enough space right now. We continue to look at different configurations for some of our state office staff in Anchorage. We're about to enter into a new lease space in Bethel because currently we have our staff spread out into spaces after the building that they were in basically collapsed. And so there's been, you know, some challenges in that region for sure. But I think right now we have adequate space. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman.
So when we were dealing with House Bill 151 last year, it was sold to us as on the principle that staff were quitting as fast as we could hire them. And I understand that. That makes sense. and that by adding new positions, we would just get ahead of that curve. So I'm not quite sure. I tried to write down the percentages you gave us. You said 35% vacancy rate currently. Is that right? And then you also said 51.7%, and I'm not sure what that was.
Okay. Senator Stevens, through the chair, currently our turnover rate is at 51.7%. We can afford to be at 35%. That's not our target. Our target would be less than that. Nationally, among all child well workforce, the turnover rate is between 30 and 40%. So we need to expect that. That's not unheard of. But ours is quite high. So we need to get ours lower, at least to 35%, so that we can start changing the trend.
Thank you, Chair. Do you recall what 51.7% was? I jotted that down, but couldn't identify. You said 51.7. You talked about 35% vacancy rate, and you also mentioned 51.7.
51.7 is our current vacancy rate.
Current vacancy, okay.
That's how many. I mean, we're basically at 50%.
Thank you.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the governor's proposed budget, are any of these vacant positions that you're describing eliminated?
Senator Begich, through the chair, no. None of our positions have been eliminated in the current governor's amended budget.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So this next slide addresses worker burnout and our attempt to address vacancies. As you heard from Mr. Owlett on Wednesday, the CRP has been really committed, and we really appreciate their support in trying to identify ways to support our staff, to acknowledge the very challenging work that they do on a daily basis, not just in actually seeing and taking in the trauma of child abuse, but navigating the very complicated governing system that is our child welfare system, with the federal, state, and then just so many expectations on our staff. So there is the employee assistance program. We do inform our staff of that. Unfortunately, many areas are not able to fully take advantage of the employee assistance program. But we are really working, and we have committed since I've become director to take a really good look at what's happening to our staff during their first year on the job, and making that onboarding process a very intentional and deliberate process, such that we try to eliminate as many external distractions and help them really focus on what's available to them to support them, really focus on their wellness, and just treat it as something that is going to happen to them, so that they need to have a plan. And in the smaller offices, it's not possible to have a wellness committee. Some offices are just too small, so we're looking at ways to support from a regional office perspective to be able to support some of the smaller offices and really try to centralize as many activities as possible around the recruitment and retention process, because frankly, our regional offices are often so much in crisis that they can't really pay attention to all the details that are needed. And so in state office, we're committed to doing as much as we can. And we are trying to work with the unions on different letters of agreement to address some of the unique challenges and create special opportunities for staff in certain areas where we need to be able to have the flexibility to offer different incentives and different support. We'd like the ability to be able to pay for paid time off after a staff person and not have to use their personal leave after they've experienced a very traumatic event. That's not something we can currently do. So there's so many things that we're trying to address on a systemic level, but it's very challenging. So we're doing what we can without a lot of money to be supportive. And then we're looking at different ways where we can leverage things like letters of agreement and our training and the private nonprofits in some communities have been extremely generous. Right now, the Beacon Hill is doing some wonderful work with our Anchorage office to help furnish the provide furniture and you know, make the place nicer. So we have many public-private. We have those public-private relationships in certain areas of the state, but they're not everywhere. That are really trying to acknowledge and trying to help us. You know, folks come in, they volunteer. We have chaplains that come in. I mean, this is really real live crisis stuff that people, that we need support. And so when you think about chaplains coming in and working with our staff, it's kind of intense, but they really appreciate it and they really love it. And we have canines, we have dogs that come in and to provide emotional support to staff in the Anchorage office, that's completely volunteer. So there's a lot of different, like, creative things that are happening in pockets, but it's, we don't really have the ability to implement anything statewide. But we are working, as much as we can, we've tried to dedicate actually a couple of staff that are solely focused on the recruitment process. Because, you know, the state's taken cuts over the years and HR is backed up. And so we can't, you know, necessarily always get the timely processing of our applicant pools the way we need. So we've had to take that into the division and, you know, really try to, you know, figure out how we're going to take this stuff on ourselves. And so we are doing everything we can within the state confines of the state system to be able to impact timely recruitment and retention. And it's going to take a lot of different strategies and a lot of effort and not, like, giving up on it because it's such a huge problem. So we're very committed to it.
Senator Begich, I think we're at our last slide. Do you have any questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to bring up the question I brought up last on Wednesday, which was one of the things that Mr. Ouellette talked about was the importance of the CRP being able to get around to different sites. And I'm wondering what the issue, you know, what in terms of their request for further travel resources, how they might be affected by the proposed reduction in travel from the administration and what the proposed travel plan for them would be in the future.
Senator Begich, to the chair, their budget, like ours, has, like, the budget for the Office of Children's Services has not been changed from last year in the current budget for 2020. It's remained the same. We have looked into the request for additional dollars. They did ask for some more money. However, they haven't totally spent all the money that they were allocated for this year so far. So they still have $48,000 available to them for travel and to support their meetings. And so should they get into the position where they do need more money, we will be able to assess that and determine if this fiscal year, if they need more. We're committed to you know, doing what we can to support them. But like all boards and commissions for the state, we've all taken, we're all having to take travel hits. So we're going to continue to support them as best we can within the budget that they've been allocated.
And just follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If assuming that they have some leftover money, is that rolled over or is that just returned? It's UGF, I assume, and it's returned?
Senator Begich, it is rolled back. I think it's – I can't really say. I'm not really sure. But, you know, whatever they don't spend, then they get a fresh new budget at the beginning of the fiscal year.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kaga?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, for all the staff you get to work with and all the years that you've put in and now being willing to take the director, thank you. It's one of the more sobering jobs in Alaska, there's no doubt about it. One of the things that we struggled with beyond just recruitment is our technology. So the ORCA system was slow to come up, but we're up and we're running, it looks like now. Then it's a matter of bandwidth, and now with new members, do you have the tools now for these people to work? And I know that we fought real hard to get bandwidth into the Bethel area. Just a report on that.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I haven't been made aware of any bandwidth issues lately, so I'm feeling like that means that it's been mostly resolved. They are slower. It is slower out there, but in general, I believe that they're able to do their work. We do struggle with the need for... we do have some IT needs, and that's the ability to make our devices more mobile. We're behind the nation in many other areas with respect to being able to use the technology that's available to us, and that technically our staff are not able to send or receive anything of a confidential nature while they're out in the field. And so we have our new commissioner has been very committed to figuring out issues with respect to being able to what we call mobile device management, and that's being able to get us some real tools that we need out in the field, because it is a hindrance. There's a lot of things that we could do quicker if we were able to be able to manage confidential information out in the field.
Mr. Chairman, surely if other communities are doing it, there must be an encryption style that can be off the shelf. Is that true, and is it just a cost issue?
Senator Coghill, I don't know that I really do not understand what the barriers are myself. I know there have been some, and part of it is that that through the Office of Information of Technology for the standardized process that went into place, we have to be careful that any technology that our particular division gets is compatible with the rest of the department and the rest of the state, and that it all fits together. So while we would love to just Lone Ranger it ourselves and go out there and get what we need, we have to work within the confines of the rest of the state, which makes sense. So it's slowed down the process for us, which is frustrating, but we have to, that's what we have to live with.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that. Something that probably we should keep asking to keep it highlighted, because that's kind of a quality of life issue for the front line workers. And there's everything from travel issues to these computer issues that are just a big part of it. And so if they had the tools, maybe they would feel a little more respected. And I wanted to bring that up because I know that's been something that has been a struggle. And I know we're living under some very frugal times, but it's not just the actual equipment itself. It's how to make that equipment work within a system. And I think that's something that we just should probably keep a fire under it. Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And sort of following up on Senator Coghill's comments, we know that there's 50% turnover. That's a shocking figure. I just have to say that you have one of the toughest jobs I have ever heard of in the state of Alaska, and thank you for doing it, and thank you for your staff who are sticking in there. So half the people every year leave the positions, but half stay, and that's pretty remarkable in a job that has a lot of a burnout, it would seem to me. Can you share with us, are there people that stay for years, are happy doing this, continue doing it, and have some support through wellness programs or whatever it is? I mean, so we've heard the bad story about 50% leaving, 50% stay, and how long did they stay? Can you give us any idea of that?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, our frontline staff vary. We do have some staff, as you say, a very small, maybe like a quarter of the staff at this time have been on the job for maybe longer than 2 to 5 years. Most staff that stay quickly promote within the system, and they become supervisors or managers, or they take other related jobs that we have that help support caseworkers and do specialty kinds of work. Many people are extremely passionate about child welfare, and they want to stay in and around the work, but they can't sustain the front line for long periods of time. So We almost don't know if it's healthy for people to stay for very long in the front line, because it is such traumatic and emotionally draining work that you start to worry about. I tend to worry about people who get exposed to that kind of trauma for that long period of time.
Thank you.
To comment on Senator Stevens' question and comment. You know, in the Mat-Su, I love some of the – we had some amazing frontline workers, and I was so upset to see them leave to become promotion and supervisor because they were so effective. And I understand that, and I love your team at the Children's Advocacy Center. I think they've been there together for multiple, 10, 5 years, 7 years for some of them. And so they're amazing staff, too. And I know that we don't always get a chance to appreciate the hard work that they do day in and day out. And so I'm appreciative of the staff that have stayed, that have the passion and drive to do this hard, continuous work. Any other comments? All right. Ms. Humphreys, is there anything else at OCS that you want to share with the committee of final comments?
Senator Wilson, thank you for this opportunity. I would share that there is one pretty exciting new initiative that we are working on, which is called Plans of Safe Care. And it's a model that looks at assisting women who may have been identified through screening during their pregnancy that have been using or abusing substances. And so it's a way to, and it's an interdisciplinary approach to assisting women prior to their birth and then at the time of birth if they're going to deliver a baby that is has potentially been substance exposed in vitro. We are working on an interdisciplinary approach. We'll be doing a pilot of this out in the Mat-Su Valley, working with birthing hospital out there and various entities to create a very systemic process for supporting moms and their babies and the whole family if substance use during the pregnancy has been an issue. And so it's called Plans of Safe Care, and we're hoping to avoid that those children having to come into the foster care system in the future. And so that's a very promising initiative that we're working on. Anything that has to do with prevention is very exciting to me. We just don't really have the opportunity with our current needs to be able to pursue prevention opportunities, but there may be others in the near future, and I can't wait to share with you those next year.
Well, thank you for providing this wonderful presentation, and as always, we look forward to seeing you next year or any other time you want to stop by and give us great news. Thus concludes our business for this afternoon. On Monday, the committee will take up Senate Bill 93, Medical Providers Incentive and Loan Repayments, also known as the Sharp 3 Bill. We will have an overview of the bill, hear from several subject matter experts, and take public testimony. It might just hold that bill over for additional amendments and possible CS. And on Wednesday, we will begin the discussion on Senate Bill 1, the repeal of Certificate of Need program. With that, thank you everyone for attending, and we are adjourned at 2:34 p.m.